Madam Chair, we are live recording and you may gavel in the meeting when ready.
Thank you. Good morning. The open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for April 22nd, 2021 will come to order. We have some late submitted documents this morning, Mr. Vice Chair.
Morning, Madam Chair. Am I coming through?
Yes.
Outstanding. Madam Chair, I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order that the Commission may consider the late submission of agenda documents number 21-22-A and 21-23-A1.
Thank you, Vice Chair. The Vice Chair has so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
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 Aye. Commissioner Walther, I wasn't able to hear you. Were you able to vote?
Commissioner Walther, hit star 6 to unmute, sir. This is Vicki. Tiffany?
Yes.
Thank you. If you
no problem.
Thank you.
I'd like to get confirmation about Commissioner Walther. We've had a little audio and technical difficulties this morning. So if we can get that, please. I can say that the motion with the 5 that we have available is approved. So based on that, Madam Secretary, the Vice Chair's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. We're going to move on to the next agenda item, but I would like to get some confirmation whether we do have the Commissioner Walther online, if he has been disconnected. So I do want to note as a procedural matter that we have a holdover of 2 items today. Item number 1, the proposed amendment to Directive 17, and item 4, OIG fiscal year 2022 appropriations language are being held over to a future meeting. So that moves into the first item on the agenda is the draft statement of policy regarding closing the file at the initial stage in the enforcement process submitted by the Vice Chair Dickerson and Commissioners Cooksey and Trainer. So let me ask, is there any presentation or discussion? And I'll turn to the Vice Chair.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Outstanding. I'm dealing with multiple devices, so I'm glad it's working. As I recall, the Acting General Counsel indicated that because this was a commissioner submission, that there would not be a presentation from the Office of General Counsel. And so, with the Commission's indulgence, I prepared a short presentation, which may not be as eloquent as we're accustomed to, but is my best effort to sort of set the stage for why I and my Republican colleagues felt that this was an important action for the Commission to take. As I and all of my colleagues are acutely aware, this Commission is charged with the unique mission of regulating political speech, which the Supreme Court has long viewed as lying at the core of the First Amendment. In creating our agency, Congress recognized the importance of nonpartisan decision-making when regulating this type of speech. And so by law, no more than 3 commissioners can represent the same political party, and at least 4 affirmative votes are required to exercise some of our most important duties and powers, including whether we decide at the initial stage in the enforcement process to find reason to believe that a violation has occurred. A vote to find reason to believe, however, even by at least 4 commissioners, does not end the matter. It simply allows our Office of General Counsel to proceed with further evaluation and to make additional recommendations to the commission. On the other hand, if we decline to find reason to believe by a vote of four commissioners, the matter ends because we lack authority under the statute to take any further action. Complainants are entitled to challenge that decision in court, and commissioners who do not see a sufficient basis to find reason to believe are obligated by law to provide their rationale to the public by drafting what we call a statement of reasons for judicial review. And in such cases, the reviewing court makes the final call. But until a case is resolved and the file is closed, the commission is bound by strict confidentiality provisions that are designed to protect the interests of those involved in enforcement matters. The fact the commission has taken a vote on a given matter, as well as any corresponding statement of reasons, cannot be released to the parties or to the public until the file for that matter is closed. For roughly the first quarter century of our existence, we made public all internal documentation of an enforcement matter once it was resolved. But in 2001, in a case called AFL-CIO against the FEC, the DC Circuit warned that in releasing enforcement information to the public, the commission must, and I'm quoting here, attempt to avoid unnecessarily infringing on First Amendment interests, end quote, namely the interests in privacy of association and belief, and balance the commission's interests in deterring future violations and promoting its own accountability with these First Amendment liberties. The purpose of this exercise and ensuring that we properly balance these competing interests is at the heart of this proposed policy statement on closing the file. It hasn't escaped our notice that there's significant gamesmanship in terms of how the confidentiality provisions, which ostensibly exist to protect respondents, are in practice weaponized and used against them. It's a familiar scenario. An individual or an organization files a complaint with the commission. It then immediately posts that complaint on its website or airs an ad describing the allegations or provides the complaint to a friendly media outlet so that they can shout from the rooftops that the respondent is, allegedly, violating federal election law. The complainants get the benefit of indignant media coverage, but the respondents are met with silence from us and end up injured, at least in the court of public opinion, by the very statute intended to protect them. Often a respondent's only recourse is to wait until the commission reaches a resolution of their matter and provides them and the public with notice that we've closed the file and will not be taking further action. If we fail to close the file, however, the respondents are effectively left to twist in the wind. Additionally, in the context of judicial review, the possible consequences for failing to close the file are especially troubling. For example, say a complainant files a lawsuit against the commission with respect to a matter where the commission has already taken a vote and has declined to find reason to believe by the requisite four votes, but has neglected, for whatever reason, to close the file and send the appropriate letters. Because we have not made our vote or our reasoning public, the complainant can reasonably assume that we have not acted at all. If the commission fails to explain the situation to the court or even show up in court, the judge could enter a default judgment against us. And if we fail to respond to that default judgment, a federal judge, deprived of the facts, could declare the commission has failed to discharge its duties under the Federal Election Campaign Act. Meanwhile, the existence of the vote itself and any associated statements of reasons languish internally and never see the light of day outside the commission. That's not the way the statute was intended to work. It's not the way the courts or the public have long assumed it works. And it is not a process that is in any way fair to the interests of the parties before us, respondents or complainants. For these reasons, we feel it's important to put in place a process that would automatically close the file at the initial stage of enforcement proceedings, where there are not at least four affirmative votes on the disposition of the matter at that stage, absent an affirmative vote to keep the matter open for further consideration. By closing the file and making the complaint, response, and certain of our internal documents public, we ensure the credibility of our enforcement by providing complainants, respondents, and the public with transparency regarding the commission's actions and reasoning. And we provide for the orderly development of the law as courts consider our arguments and litigation raised from one of the matters we consider. Accounting for these considerations is, in my view, part and parcel of the faithful execution of our mission. Ultimately, a commission that fails to provide the public with an accounting of its decisions and reasoning makes itself a party to a farce or a tragedy, or perhaps in some cases, both. For these reasons, I sincerely hope my colleagues will join me in approving this document and ensuring that the Commission operates openly so that our actions can be reviewed by the parties before us, the public, and the courts. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Are there any further discussion or comments? Commissioner Weintraub?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. I will not be able to support the proposal, which basically takes the decision to dismiss a case out of the hands of a bipartisan group of commissioners. At least we all agree that decisions are supposed to be made on a bipartisan basis, and would vest it with a partisan minority of the commission. And that is indeed the point. That's really what's going on here. And to understand how this really works and what's behind it, one has to look a little bit at the history of the commission. Because this all comes down to what happens when we can't agree, what happens in split vote cases. For most of the commission's history, actually, split votes were fairly rare. The commissioners worked pretty hard to find common ground, to reach a consensus, to find some place where four commissioners could land. But things started to change back in 2008, when we had substantial turnover on the commission. That was after the first time we lost quorum. And when the quorum was regained, there was turnover and there was a new way of doing business around here. And split votes started to rise and penalties started to decline. And a lot of people, myself included, think that enforcement of the law suffered. Now, in virtually every split vote case in the last 12 years, now it's early days with this group of commissioners, so I'm talking mostly historically, but with a couple of exceptions, in virtually every case where the commission split, regardless of who was the respondent, the vote count was the same. The Republican commissioners voted against taking any step to enforce the law, against opening an investigation, against trying to find out what happened, against trying to conciliate, trying to settle the case. And the Democratic and independent commissioners voted in favor of taking some step to enforce the law. And this was really a sea change in the way that the commission had functioned in the past, because as I said, it didn't matter who the respondent was in any of these cases. It could have been a Democrat, it could have been a Republican. It happened when the respondent was Hillary Clinton. It happened when the respondent was Donald Trump. It happened when the respondent was the pro-Russian Party of Regions. 3-3 votes or 2-2 votes, depending on how many commissioners we had on board at the time. Democratic and independent commissioners voting to move forward and Republican commissioners voting to block enforcement. So, the one small power that is left to those of us who want to see the law enforced is that decision whether or not to dismiss the case or whether there is some path forward, whether we could continue to work on it. And this policy would take that decision away from us. We would be ceding control to our Republican colleagues. They would get to decide when a case got to be dismissed and when it didn't, because as soon as we have a motion on the table, if there aren't four votes to do anything, then the case would automatically close. We wouldn't have that vote to close the file and dismiss the case. This is contrary, in addition to being contrary to the law that says let's see if I can find a law, all decisions of the commission with respect to the exercise of its duties and powers under the provisions of this act shall be made by a majority vote of the members of the commission. And as my colleague said, many of the most important decisions are made on a four vote decision. We have a directive that says that even more decisions should be made on a four vote basis to make sure that we have bipartisanship. I think most complainants and respondents would agree that it's a pretty substantive decision when we decide whether or not to dismiss the case. And there have been many cases where there have been long discussions, multiple discussions over multiple meetings. We've had cases that have stretched on for months, and cases that have stretched on for years, while commissioners went back and forth and tried to decide what to do with the matter. And, you know, I'm not going to say that having a case drag on that long is the ideal situation, but commissioners were exercising their role under the statute in trying to decide what to do. There were, we've had many cases where there were votes on a matter in one meeting, and then the case would be held over and we would discuss it in a further meeting. Sometimes it would get delayed through any number of meetings, and none of that would be possible. And sometimes at the end of the day, we came to some resolution after all that time. None of that would be possible under this provision, unless, of course, we had the permission of our Republican colleagues to hold the case over longer. Once there was one motion made under this policy, it would automatically close the file unless there were four votes to hold it open. And to just give a sense of how nonsensical this policy would be in practice, there could be a motion to dismiss that failed, let's say 3-3, but the vote count could be anything. The motion to dismiss fails. Therefore, the case should not be dismissed. But no, under this magical policy, after the motion to dismiss fails, the case is dismissed anyway. So it just doesn't make any sense at all. It's, you know, heads you win, tails I lose. And I don't need your permission to exercise my authority as a commissioner. This is not the way the commission has ever done business. We don't delegate and can't under the statute delegate our authority to any other person, including another commissioner. So I think this policy would be bad for enforcement. And it would diminish the role of the Democratic and independent commissioners who have a stronger interest, apparently, in enforcing the law. And I don't know why I would agree to such a policy. It was ironically announced on April 1st, April Fool's Day. And I think I would be a fool to support this policy, because I would be giving up the authority and the power that I have under the statute to my Republican colleagues and leave them solely in charge of when cases get dismissed. So for all of those reasons, I cannot support this policy. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. Yes, Vice Chair, please.
Thank you. Commissioner Weintraub is, as always, eminently quotable, but a few sort of thoughts that I think have been left out of the analysis. I would add one fairly important variable to Commissioner Weintraub's timeline. Her statement was that in 2008, things changed due to a change in personnel on the commission. I think she ignores the fairly obvious fact that the constitutional law governing this agency shifted dramatically in 2007 and 2008. She quoted the heads you win, tails you lose language, which of course comes from Wisconsin Right to Life 2, decided in 2008. And so I think that she ignores the fact that the job got a lot harder in that time. And I understand she disagrees with binding decisions of the Supreme Court, and that's her privilege. But of course, they do bind us. And one of the powers and duties of the commission is not the privilege of ignoring the interpretations of the Supreme Court on matters of First Amendment law. So I would take issue with that part of the narrative. I think what has developed is that as the law has shifted, as the volume of complaints has risen, it has become harder to, there have been more hard cases. There have been more cases with those sort of constitutional dimensions. And so, yes, it has been harder to reach consensus and compromise. I just want to add one point for myself on this, because I work very hard for compromise in this role, and I respectfully think that I accomplish it with some regularity. But compromise is not symmetrical in the context of enforcement. If you sincerely believe there's reason to believe for a violation has occurred. Then you as a commissioner, and I'm speaking here generally, not specifically of Commissioner Weintraub, you know, any of us have the discretion at that point to adjust the remedy, to exercise leniency, to, you know, engage in mercy. The range of compromise available, if you believe a violation has occurred, is quite large. And I think there were more clear violations before 2008, and so more opportunities for those sort of conversations. If conversely, you do not believe, you, any of us as commissioners, do not believe there is reason to believe a violation occurred, to trade our votes as part of a compromise would be deeply unethical and a violation of our oath. So I understand Commissioner Weintraub's and maybe others' desire to get back to a place where there's more consensus, but I think the lack of consensus stems not from the personnel on the commission, but from fundamental changes in the constitutional law governing this agency, which we do not control. And the fact that, again, speaking for myself, if I don't believe that we have grounds under the law to move forward, I do not consider myself at liberty to compromise on that finding. I think that'd be a fairly obvious and fundamental violation of due process that is not in keeping with our traditions of the country. So with that, with those brief comments, I'd be curious if anyone else has thoughts. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Let me ask to our fellow colleagues, are there any desire to join in this discussion? Commissioner Cooksey, please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'll try to be brief. I wanted to explain why I'll be supporting the proposal, and I wanted to emphasize a few points that have already been made by the Vice Chair, but I think are worthy of emphasis and repeating about why I think this proposal is important, why I don't agree with Commissioner Weintraub's objections to the proposal, and I think some of them are based on incorrect understandings of the law and our practice, and then also sort of what some of the risks are if we don't adopt this policy and continue with this practice or a possibility of having unclosed files that have been adjudicated on the merits. So I think this policy is critical for several reasons. The first is it's important because it acknowledges the reality of the action of closing the file, which is that it is a ministerial act. It is separate and apart from the commission's conclusion on the merits of an underlying matter. It's just an acknowledgement of our deliberation on the matter. Congress said that we need 4 votes to proceed to make a substantive action on a case. If we fail to get 4 votes, that means we've failed to proceed. We should acknowledge that the case is over and let the public, and more importantly, the respondents and the complainant, know that. I think this proposal would thereby remove the perverse incentive to deceive, mislead, and hide information from the parties and subsequently from federal courts if hypothetically a block of commissioners were strategically voting to refuse to close files that have been adjudicated and that might be subject to outside litigation. And I don't think it prejudices us to adopt this policy if there is desire among commissioners to continue a deliberative process, because as the policy contemplates, the case can be left open if 4 commissioners feel there is something left to discuss or something left to be decided, or if there is room for consensus. And of course, because it takes 4 commissioners to reach any merits decision, it makes sense that it would take 4 commissioners to continue that discussion. If 3 commissioners have decided, I've made up my mind, there's nothing left to do in this case, then it doesn't make sense to keep the file open indefinitely, because obviously there's not going to be a merits decision on that. So that sort of brings me to my second point, which is at this moment, I really can't think of any reason why any commissioner would oppose this policy with respect to Commissioner Weintraub, unless it was because of a desire to engage in gamesmanship and to engage in procedural hijinks to have this commission hide cases being adjudicated. It's no answer, as I just said, that we need time for additional discussion deliberation. This policy addresses that. So that's just not, in my opinion, a fair reason to vote against it. And I think anyone watching this, seeing this policy fail, I think they would be justified in concluding that it's because of a desire to keep these cases closed indefinitely, to hide our deliberation and the outcomes from the respondents, and to keep people in administrative limbo and to keep federal courts in the dark. I also don't think it's right to say that this policy would be illegal. As I said earlier, closing the file is a ministerial act. I have to disagree with Commissioner Weintraub. Voting to close the file is not a vote to dismiss. Voting to dismiss is a vote to dismiss. Voting to close the file is an acknowledgement that we have adjudicated the case and that it's over. And to that point, as evidence of the fact that it's a ministerial act, we have closed files, or it is possible to close files, with fewer than 4 votes, which is evidence that it is not a substantive action under the statute. So it's simply wrong to say that closing the file is a substantive action under the statute. It's incorrect. So, but this really just also leads to my third point, which is I think this point may be the most important of them all. If the commission gets into a situation where a block of commissioners are strategically refusing to close case files that have been adjudicated, and we have respondents out there who are being left in the dark about the status of those cases, the commission and those respondents, you know, if they also subsequently become embroiled in litigation over those cases, where these respondents have to intervene to defend themselves where the agency refuses, I think that situation would lead this agency down a very, very dark road. It is not a stable status quo. It is not a center that can hold, both within the agency and outside of it. And I think among other things that would happen within the commission, I think we would become increasingly liable to litigation from respondents whose cases have not been made public and who are dragged into litigation over the FEC's failure to acknowledge that we've adjudicated their cases. And then when those respondents are subject to litigation, some of those respondents might begin to write to us to waive their confidentiality and ask for their case files. Some of those respondents might seek discovery against the commission to get their case files. Some respondents might even get the idea to sue the FEC under the Administrative Procedures Act, arguing that our refusal to close the file is arbitrary and capricious. And if the commission were able to appear and defend itself in an Administrative Procedures Act case, I'm really not sure what we would say or how we would defend our refusal to close the file. And I really want to avoid that situation. So I hope that we can adopt a policy like this where we can start to adjudicate these files and acknowledge those adjudications to the public, because I think that represents the reality of what we're doing. So I'll be supporting this policy, and I hope other commissioners will as well.
Before I turn to you, Commissioner Weintraub, let me make sure that I've made that offer to other commissioners that have not had the opportunity to join the discussion. So I want to, Commissioner Walther, Commissioner Traynor, not asking you to speak if you choose not to, just want to make sure that I've recognized. Thank you. So Commissioner Weintraub, please. Excuse me. Yes, Commissioner Walther.
I didn't know if I was still, the way we're set up, whether I was able to be heard or not. I would like to comment support for Commissioner Weintraub's approach. I've been under it for a number of years. I don't think it's really an issue of the composition of the commissioners, because we all have our ups and downs in some ways, but day in and day out, we get the job done. It's not always pretty, but Congress made a deliberate decision to, I think, make us have, come to a matter, even though, we know it's be a lot more sleek if we could decide something on a basis where you have a clear majority. But when we're set up in this way, the parties are forced to collaborate with each other and communicate with each other. And if it's positive to do that, or, we make a lot of decisions by thinking through things and maybe narrowing the issue to the point where we can find agreement, I think this is all to the better. And I've seen it's really very frustrating, and believe me, it's very frustrating sometimes, to see, you know, that those with whom I disagree to proceed and prevail. But that's the way it works here. We aren't built to have a disagreement or a lopsided view. It's one to, you know, come together and try and make the best we can of all of the issues. And sometimes we do, I think, a great job, and sometimes it could be better, and sometimes maybe it's not so great. But democracy isn't perfect, and the way we proceed isn't perfect. But in a case like this, I think if we were to, what I perceive to be, would be more of a political ball in some ways to do otherwise. But I think we're at a time right now where we're at a loggerheads on how to go ahead. There may be a way, and I can think of some that might work, or not some, but, you know, possible approaches. But when it comes right down to it, I don't think that it behooves us to create a situation by changing it in the situation here that's being talked about, where you don't close the file and it sits there forever. Okay, that's fine. But if you have to, but one side or the other would be the one that would, I guess, prevail. And I'm not sure that by just not leaving it where it is, rather than trying to get, you know, doesn't get the job done if we can't, you know, move any farther. So I'm not sure we will improve on our system of justice if we, do a flip and say, okay, now this side is always going to prevail in this because, there was on the dismissal, there was a vote to dismiss, but not a vote to close the file. So I'm going to continue my support for that position. I'm not saying that there may not be some ways, there may be some ways in which we can moderate the consequences of it. I think at this point, it's not pretty, but it's more in keeping than what Congress wanted, than to make a new kind of 50-50 that isn't consistent with the way it got done in the original part of the proceeding. So that's my thinking on the point at this point. I'm not to say that we can't talk further about how to unplug it on occasion, but until we can do that, I like the status quo.
Thank you, Commissioner Walker. Let me just check with my colleagues. Anyone else like to join? If I may, if I just share a few words, Commissioner Weintraub, then I'm happy to turn back to you. I will not be supporting the Vice Chair and Commissioner Cooksey and Commissioner Traynor's statement of policy. I believe that the intention of the statute is to work in a bipartisan nature for this action as well, and do not consider it a ministerial action. And I think Commissioner Cooksey might have been quoting a little bit from the comment that we received today, when the comment that the proposal is his assertion that it's not illegal. But I want to ask, does anyone have any discussion, or do we want to bring the comment that we received into the discussion that we're having today? Because I felt that comment that we received was very on point and addressed a lot of the concerns that I had of how this statement of policy would change something to an affirmative, as opposed to having to have the four votes. I truly believe that the intention of this statute and this agency is to work together across the board to find compromise. And having a short period of time been a commissioner here, it is not always going to happen, but I do see diligent efforts across all sides to try to find that when it is available. And I think it is supposed to happen in this instance as well. So I appreciate the comments that all have said, but I agree with Commissioner Weintraub and Commissioner Walter, and I will not be voting in support of this motion. But I do see that there's continued discussion, and I'm open to having that discussion with the Vice Chair and Commissioner Cooksey and Traynor. So Commissioner Weintraub, would you like to join in?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to unduly prolong this because I can count. I just want to say that I strongly disagree with Commissioner Cooksey that the close the file vote is ministerial. The statute plainly contemplates that dismissals will be by votes. It speaks about votes to dismiss in the statute. And at a minimum, those substantive decisions have to be by majority vote, not on a split vote. To my knowledge, has never been a case that was not ultimately dismissed on a vote to close the file. Sometimes we have a formal dismissal motion and then a vote to close the file, but the close the file is not ministerial. And we know this because there are consequences for dismissing a case. It allows for someone to sue under certain circumstances under GA8. And there's a 60-day clock that starts running from the time we dismiss the case. We have had cases where, as I said, we've had multiple votes on it and then close the file at some later point. And that 60-day clock has never started to run until we actually close the file. That's the trigger for dismissal, for those dismissal suits. I think my colleague's position is pretty clear when they say when they've made up their mind, the case is adjudicated. Our votes don't matter. They've decided, we're done. So apparently, you know, right now there's a big debate in around Washington as to what is the ideal number of commissioners. My colleagues seem to think the ideal number of commissioners is 3, all Republican, and that the Republican commissioners get to control the outcome, and then there might be 3 other chairs at the table, but, you know, we wouldn't have full rights because once they've decided what to do with the case, the case is over. Under this policy, for example, a Republican chair could set up an executive agenda and just stack dozens of cases. Right now, of course, we have hundreds of cases, but, you know, stack one case after another, recognize a colleague for a motion to dismiss, the motion would fail, but it wouldn't matter because at the end of the day, the cases would all be dismissed anyway. And we could just have motion to dismiss, motion fails, move on, motion to dismiss, motion fails, move on. And then magically at the end of the day under this policy, all of those cases would be dismissed. The files would be closed and they would be done. And that would be, and there would be nothing that we could do to stop that under this policy. You know, as I said, it would just be giving up the authority of the commissioners who have a more pro-enforcement point of view. We can all disagree on, and we will, and we have, and we will again on the meaning of various Supreme Court decisions. But, and we're not alone in that. Lawyers all over town and all over the country disagree on the meanings of Supreme Court decisions. But at the end of the day, we get to decide together what to do with the case. And I am not going to cede my authority as would happen under this policy.
Commissioner Madam Finch. Chair.
Yes.
So I'm coming up in 2 months, I will have been on the commission for a year. And as Commissioner Weintraub said, up until 2018, I believe she said, this really was not an issue. But in my time on the commission, where we've had this split between commissioners and this willingness to work to come to some resolution, I have yet to once have anyone reach out to change my mind with regard to a position that I've taken where we've had a 3-3 split. In a particular case. Now, I have myself reached out to other commissioners to try to get them to move towards my position in a particular matter. And what I find most disturbing about this discussion about whether or not we could continue to work on these cases is that for my almost entire year that we've been here, I have not seen one of these cases where there has been an initial split and then a refusal to close the file put back on an agenda for the commission to consider. It hadn't happened one time. And so I think it's very disingenuous to say that we're going to work towards compromise and then not see these same matters again. And in fact, have no one reach out to you and say, hey, I need you to move towards my position, or what do we need to do to get to a compromise position? So I think it's very disingenuous. I think it's very, very misleading to the public to say that these things are going on behind closed doors and we're trying to get to some sort of compromise. What it is that each side appears to have dug in, and we're going to just continue with a rule change that took place, or a procedural change that took place by a vote of a block of commissioners to keep these files as these zombie files that just continue to hang around the commission for years on end. In fact, I would venture to guess that there are probably cases where the statute of limitations has even expired, where votes have been taken and they haven't even been put back onto the agenda to be considered. So clearly, I think this is a procedure that we need to have in place to avoid the perception that the commission is not taking action. And I think it is absolutely abhorrent that we refuse to allow the judiciary to have access to these files and access to this information when the commission has taken definitive action and both sides have made very clear what their position is, and the judiciary could benefit from both sides having given their information to the courts in these delay suits. I also find it odd that the commenters that the chair brought up, are concerned about the commission being able to do its job, and yet they're some of the first people to run to the courthouse when we don't get through a case in the statutory period of time. This procedure would make that time frame be much quicker and would allow them to have an adjudication of cases that they file, that they could then make a determination on the law, as opposed to procedural aspects of whether or not the commission had delayed their actions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner Traynor. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair.
Just one quick, I guess, thought. Commissioner Weintraub has spoken in very strong terms about her authority as a commissioner, the ceding of power that would be going on here. I think that is wrong as a factual matter. For the vast majority of Commissioner Weintraub's time here, this was recognized as ministerial, more or less explicitly, was the practice. So really, this is a request to return to the status quo as was practiced up until, at least by my records, 2018. So I think suggesting this is an attempt to undo a nearly half century old statute, when really it's an attempt to go to turn back the clock a few years, is heated rhetoric, but I'm not sure it quite matches up with the facts. One just sort of statement of this general legal theory, I guess. I'm really struggling to understand why it is so curious to people that when there's a split, there's not a majority to move forward with enforcement, that the presumption is you don't enforce. I mean, this is fundamental to law enforcement. It's fundamental to how we adjudicate rights in this country, not just this country, in the entire legal history of every system I have any familiarity with, going back centuries, that the presumption is in favor of the defense, in the favor of the respondent. And that to overcome that presumption, the government needs to bear a burden. It needs to get to a majority of whatever the decision body is. So I think it's very odd to me to hear such heated rhetoric around the very basic concept that where a body is evenly divided on whether to move forward with enforcement, you don't move forward with enforcement. That's not a new concept. It applies all sorts of places outside this agency that don't implicate the First Amendment. And I think it's part of why I at least am so frankly confused by the opposition here. I don't think that recognizing an equally divided commission can't enforce is anything more than recognizing that no equally divided organization can enforce anywhere. And that, you know, that's what the statute says. So I take some issue with the strength of Commissioner Weintraub's rhetoric, given that I think there's a really basic principle of due process at stake here. And so I hope maybe we can dial that back in future discussions, even if this does not move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Any further discussion? Is there a motion?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair, please.
I move the adoption of agenda document number 21-21-A.
Thank you. The Vice Chair is so moved. Is there a discussion on this motion? Seeing none, I will call the question. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, please say no. No.
No.
No.
The motion fails with 3 voting in favor, the Vice Chair, Commissioner Traynor, Commissioner Cooksey, and 3 voting against the motion, Commissioner Weintraub, Walther, and myself. Thank you. Madam Secretary, that motion fails. The next item on the agenda is the draft notice of availability of Reg 2021-01 candidate salaries. We have Kevin Paulson and Amy Rothstein from OGC here to discuss the matter. I give full time for Mr. Paulson to get logged and give me a thumbs up. And then when you're ready, feel free to go ahead and proceed, Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Commissioners. Before you is agenda document 21-22-A, a draft notification of availability in response to a petition for rulemaking received from Nabila Islam. The petition asks the commission to amend its regulations regarding candidate salaries and permissible use of campaign funds. If approved, the draft NOA will be published in the Federal Register and the commission will receive public comments on the petition for a period of 60 days. Thank you, and I'm happy to address any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for OGC? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No questions, but I think this is a really interesting petition and has the potential to open the door to more people of diverse means and diverse backgrounds running for office. And I think that would be, if that were the result, that would be a good thing for our country. I'd be really interested. I hope people will comment on this. And because if we were to go forward with a rulemaking, the comments could help to inform how we frame the notice of proposed rulemaking. This is just a petition. It goes out for comment and then we decide whether we're gonna open a rulemaking or not. I some questions I might be interested in is, you know, would we, if we were to go down this road, would it be advisable to have some additional disclosure to make sure that donors understood what their money was going for? Does it pose a small risk of scammers taking advantage of these kinds of policies to set up faux campaigns in order to raise money and just pay themselves a salary? If so, are there things we could do to prevent that? And is that risk counteracted by the benefits that could be accomplished by allowing more people to run for office? And the concern about being able to buy healthcare is one that I think is really important. So I appreciate that the petitioner sent us this interesting petition, and I look forward to the comments.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. Any further? I would also like to say thank you to the petitioner for this. Running for office is a full-time job, and when you are not in a wealthy position, then you are struggling to have just the daily life expenses, healthcare expenses, let alone but trying to make a competitive race. I think it provides an opportunity to be able to reach underrepresented individuals in this country and to get a voice inside of our halls of Congress that might not be the atypical. because you have women that may be at home, husbands that may be at home taking care of children. You have minorities that do not have the means to be able to quit a job to be able to run for office. But every single one of these individuals have something worthy to contribute to this political process. So I do think there's some interesting issues raised. As Commissioner Weintraub mentioned, I think there is the concern that we would have to look at some additional disclaimer issues because the petition suggests 6 months at a minimum, a year for a minimum, that automatically brought some questions of potential concerns. But I am excited to see the possibility of what comments that could be made and the potential that we could open this opportunity for a greater expansion to our electorate. So I think it's a very interesting petition. I think that's the right words for it. And I'm happy to see what we can do on this at the appropriate time. But I want to open this up. Anything further from our colleagues?
Madam Chair?
Please, Commissioner Cooksey.
Very briefly, I agree it is an interesting petition. I'm happy to move forward with it. And because this is not a decision on the merits, just to see what the public's views are on these issues. I share some of Commissioner Weintraub's concerns. I share concerns about running for political office being a money-making enterprise for the candidates and people who are making more money than they previously were. I also think I would be interested in knowing people's views on whether the provision for healthcare is necessary, given that you can purchase healthcare with the salary that you're paying yourself as a candidate, and whether this is duplicative, or and then of course any interest in disclosure, accountability, and avoiding waste, what I'll just generally call waste, fraud, and abuse, which is a good government term for making sure that these provisions are being run the right way. So I'm happy to support this today, and I'll look forward to the comments that come in.
Thank you, Commissioner Hooksey. Any further? Is there a motion?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair.
I'd be happy to move approval of the document. If we need a more formal invocation of words, I'd be happy to have the shibboleth explained to me by the Office of General Counsel, but I agree we should move forward on this matter.
I don't think that much formality needs to be had in this one. And we have the shaking of the head from our general counsel. So I appreciate that. So with that motion that we have from the vice chair to approve the document, I ask, is there any discussion on that motion? Seeing no interest, I will call the question. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Thank you. The motion passes 6-0. We're going to move on to the next item on the agenda. The next item on the agenda is a proposed commission actions to address scam packs. And we have Ms. Debbie Ciccone, Ryan Lance of the Office of Compliance, Mr. Greg Scott of the Office of the Information Division, and Paul Clark of the Office of the Chief Information Officer. And I believe Ms. Ciccone may be leading this presentation, so feel free to start. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, commissioners. The memorandum before you provides two recommendations from the Scam Pack Working Group, comprised of staff from several divisions within the agency, and aims to improve transparency and public outreach and to educate the public on how political committees are spending their funds. The first recommendation proposes several updates to the FEC's website. The proposed updates would help the public identify committees that have raised large sums of money, but have spent little or none of that money on contributions to or expenditures in support of or opposition to candidates, otherwise known as direct candidate support. The proposed updates aim to improve how existing data is displayed so potential contributors could be better informed about the activities of the political committees that they may want to contribute to. The second recommendation proposes the development of a short video to be posted on the FEC's YouTube channel, which would demonstrate how to navigate the FEC website in order to view information regarding committees' receipts and disbursements, including from the proposed website changes, how to isolate a committee's spending on direct candidate support, and how to compare a committee's spending on direct candidate support to its spending on other expenses. I'm now going to turn it over to Ryan Lance from the Reports Analysis Division and Paul Clark from the Office of the Chief Information Officer, who will provide visuals and an explanation of the proposed website updates.
Good morning, commissioners. I will now walk through a series of proposed changes for the FEC website, and will be sharing my screen to show mockups of the proposed changes. I just want to check and make sure, can people see my screen correctly? Yes, perfect, okay. So the first proposal, displaying political committees' aggregated direct candidate support activity. This would be displayed on a committee's profile page. A new column could be added next to the totals that provide a financial summary for the committee. The new column would show a percentage that each figure represents as part of their overall spending. Additionally, the lines that represent contributions to federal committees and candidates, independent expenditures, and coordinated party expenditures could be lumped together in a category titled Direct Candidate Support, which could then show the combined percentage of direct candidate support for the committee. The second proposal, displaying percentage of political committees disbursements spent on specific vendors. This would be displayed on a committee's profile page that shows a list of vendors used by the committee. A new column would be added that shows the percentage of total disbursements each vendor received from the committee. The third proposal would be adding a new search parameter for filtering data. This proposal has already been implemented on the commission's website. This specifically allows someone to filter committee's activity by one or more specific line numbers. This helps show those disbursements that are being made for direct candidate support, but it can be used for other line numbers as well. The fourth proposal, adding new search parameters to the committee search page. Under this proposal, new search parameters would be added to the committee search page. Specifically, a user would be able to search for a specific activity, such as direct candidate support, and plug in a percentage that activity represents for committees, and then the website would return a list of committees that meet that criteria. Someone could then pull a list of committees with either high or low percentage of direct candidate support. And then the fifth proposal would be amending column headers on the political committee search page. Under this proposal, we would add language to the committee search page to better identify those committees that are authorized by a candidate and those that are not authorized by a candidate. This would help someone that may not be as familiar with FEC legal terms, such as the term political action committee. And now I will turn it over to Paul Clark for the final proposal.
Madam Chair, good morning. The presentation about recommendation number 6 will be short because we don't have any visuals for this one. The website team discussed two options, one tabular and one graphical. The tabular option would display a list of committees along with financial data and direct candidate support. The table's columns would be sortable, allowing users to order data in a way that's most useful to them. The graphical option would allow website users to select two committees. Once selected, the website would display each committee's information in a scatter plot, allowing users to compare two committees' financial activity. And I would like to end, the mockups that we've displayed here or presented here are for illustrative purposes only. And if we get approval for one or several of these options, we would go through our normal website development process of design and usability testing. And now I'll hand it back to Debbie.
Thank you, Paul and Ryan, for that presentation. I'm now going to turn it over to Greg Scott, the Assistant Staff Director of the FEC's Information Division, who will say a few words about the second recommendation.
Thank you, Debbie, and good morning, commissioners. As Debbie mentioned at the outset, the last element of this proposal involves some educational outreach. And the goal of this effort would be to help potential contributors use the tools that are available to them to make an informed choice when they're deciding whether to contribute to a particular political committee. Specifically, we're going to propose creating an instructional video that would demonstrate how to navigate some of the data that Ryan and Paul just described. And that video would be posted both on the agency's YouTube channel and on the commission's website. So the working group recommends that the commission approve the recommendations set forth in the agenda document to improve transparency and help the public make these informed decisions when contributing to political committees. Thank you, and we would be happy to respond to any questions.
I want to say thank you to the team. The presentation and the intentions behind it, I think, would hit a very striking problem that we have because scam packs are harmful. I'm going to take it on a personal note. One of the first cases that I had when I joined the FEC as a staff attorney in 2008 turned out to be a scam pack. But at the time, we didn't even have the language for it at the time. Not that it was so long ago, but we just hadn't developed anything like that. And what I was taken aback by is that this was a committee, a minority committee in a district that was not typically, the candidate was a Republican candidate, and that is not a very well-known Republican district. It was outside of the Atlanta area. And this candidate received almost $1 million. And I was struck by that because I was making the assumption, how could that candidate? And so when I dug into that case that had nothing to do with a scam pack, was completely a disclaimer issue, which in some direct way does kind of touch on scam packs, I was amazed that this individual, this committee had counsel and consulting and fundraising and all of these kind of very sophisticated things for a campaign that was extremely unsophisticated. And when I dug in a little further, how much money actually went to the candidate support was nowhere near anything that would have made a successful candidate. And I wondered when they set themselves up for this deal, did they understand that they were not going to be receiving any of the money? So I am the person, I don't think it's a surprise to my colleagues that I am the person that asked for this document to go blue, because I see this as an issue that just not, what is it, last week, the FBI published a report. And one of the things that was said is that we need to work on the front end as opposed to just the tail end when we've already, the damage has been done. I see these proposals as a way so that we can help the contributors to have a better understanding of how their funds are being used. Because whether it is a low dollar or large dollar, the intention I believe is that you're going to support the candidate and the causes that you believe in, not lining someone else's pocket for profits. So that might not be the very sophisticated way to say it, but I'd like to start the discussion for this. But I'm also not going to be asking for a vote on this today because I believe there's additional work that needs to be done. So all of that said, I do have a couple of questions that I would like to ask the team if they could. And this might go directly to you, Ms. Jacona, first. How did we identify the direct candidate support as the appropriate indicator for scam pack activity? And did we look at any other metrics or are there other metrics that we could consider?
We just determined, you know, the categories that actually the candidates will benefit from in terms of actual support. So we just looked at, you know, the categories, the contributions, you know, independent expenditures and coordinated party expenditures. So that's how it's been defined in terms of, you know, the actual forms. On one of the forms, FEC Form 3X, there's a reference to direct candidate support and then a reporting scenario where, you know, if there is direct candidate support in these categories, that this is how you disclose it. So that's really where we came up with that categorization.
Thank you. And also, item 5 in the memorandum proposes amending column headers on political committee search pages to clarify that authorized committees are those authorized by a candidate and independent expenditures are not authorized. How easy is that change going to be to make? And can it be accomplished relatively quickly?
Madam Chair, if it was just the labels on the website and the filters, that change is fairly easy and could happen fairly quickly.
Thank you. I want to make sure that I allow, sorry, to my colleagues, if you have any questions or you'd like to direct, please do jump in, let me know.
Madam Chair.
Please, Commissioner Cooksey.
I have, I think, just two questions. One is a fairly basic question for, I guess, for Ms. Jacona or for anyone else who feels equipped to answer. Do we have any statutory or regulatory definition for what a scam PAC is?
Madam Chair.
Please, Ms. Chacona.
Not to my knowledge, no.
Okay, thank you. And my second question is a more technical question about the calculation of direct candidate support. Based on the document, it says direct candidate support includes contributions to federal candidate committees, independent expenditures, and coordinated party expenditures. Does this mean that committees who expend funds for state candidates that spending would not be included in direct candidate support?
Madam Chair.
Please, Ms. Chacon.
It would not be, based on our calculations, how we were looking at it, it would just be for federal candidate support.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I want to make sure, any other questions or questions from our colleagues? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not so much a question as to comment. This is part of a longstanding project. It's been an area of longstanding concern at the Commission. I can remember having discussions with the working group with former Commissioner Peterson. Obviously, that was a little while ago, but I really appreciate the efforts of the staff. We were able to put together a working group that really went across the agency and drew on the various expertises of a lot of different people, and they put in a lot of work on this project. This is just the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot of other work that has gone on trying to get at how do we deal with this problem? How do we provide better information to the public so that they can make better informed choices and fundamentally ultimately not get ripped off. And I also want to thank you, Madam Chair, for your leadership on this issue and for continuing to raise it up and make sure that we don't, in the press of the many other things that are on our plate, that we don't forget about this issue and that we do try to make some progress on this.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. But as you said, all thanks goes to that team that covers all the divisions and who put in years of effort on that. So I want to join in on that. I greatly appreciate their work. The proposal, while I'm ready to support it now, I've made it very clear I'm not going to be asking for a vote on this because I think there's a little bit more work that can be done to flesh this out even more for everyone. And so I would like the group to provide some further research on whether there are additional or alternative metrics that we could, that would be more helpful to the public in identifying potential scam packs. And I'd like OCIO to determine the volume of work needed. There's a footnote in the document that specifically says to move forward, we'd have to reach out to OCIO, forgive me if I'm giving the wrong acronyms, but to be able to determine how the cost of the development, the time needed, the implementation, and how that affects staff, because clearly we have to consider budget restrictions. I'm not a part of the finance committee, so I do not want to step into that realm, but I want to be respectful that there are two, and obviously they're on the screen right now, two individuals that are on that finance committee, so that would have to go to that consideration as well. But I think it would benefit everybody to know the numbers so we can have some comfort whether we could proceed with that. And I want to work with the FSC staff to develop a more detail on proposal item 6. We're creating the scam pack snapshot page. And I think there was something important that was mentioned by Commissioner Cooksey about the definitions itself of a scam pack. We need to work on some internal definitions of that. And obviously there would have to be consideration by the whole commission. But the purpose of today was to try to get some of this out so that we can give staff some leeway to be able to move forward with the next steps, because you've done so much great work, but it does take a little bit of a additional encouragement from the commission to do so. But as I highlighted, this was not an intention to call this matter for a vote, but I have had very substantive discussions with nearly all of my colleagues. Thank you to the vice chair, because the two of us have spoken, and not to obligate you in any ways, and I do not say it to obligate you, but we have both made a commitment to try to work on this together so we can move that forward. So I appreciate that. And Commissioner Weintraub is right. She has been highlighting this from the start. And just to give everyone a heads up, that very first case I mentioned, Commissioner Weintraub herself pointed that out to me and said, "Don't you think something's wrong with this?" And I did. So it's always stuck with me. So Thank you to the staff. I want to make sure that I've given all my colleagues an opportunity to address this if you would like. I see everyone.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Commissioner Walther.
Thanks. Yeah, I think it's a really fine idea. I've got some questions that were kind of nagging at me. And one is, to what extent do we have the jurisdiction to engage in that, given the fact that most of the time our documents are prepared in the sense of how much have you contributed, how much have you not? We've not tried to get into the methodology of what the voter or a contributor may want. So it's, you know, kind of in my view that if a contributor wants to spend money pretty much as long as it's legal, however they want, should we be there to challenge that? And at what point do we want to start disclosure to the public about how much has gone to X as opposed to Y? That's a very huge amount of information that our agency will have to look at carefully, I think, cost-wise, but also just who makes those decisions as to, for example, we're talking today about what categories to use, and perhaps I'm not familiar enough with how that would go. And what if we see something that doesn't look good to us some of the people in our office and say, hey, wait, this looks way out of line. Are we going to report that to some governmental agency? Are we going to put up a little sign in our website that says warning, if anything, you know, or what will we do with the information when it appears, right or wrong, to look questionable?
Thank you, Commissioner Walther. Before Ms. Chacona, first, this information is already disclosed, so we're not seeking any new information. This is just merely the way that it could be displayed to give some guidance to those contributors. And contributors, of course, can still continue to give their money in any way that they choose. This is an attempt to address an issue that the FBI noticed that was addressed in an article at least last week, where individuals are giving their money in one capacity, believing the intention would go to candidate support, and the money went to filling the pockets of those individuals soliciting repeatedly or consulting. So this information is already available, but Ms. Chacona, I believe I kind of interrupted you, so if you would like to go ahead, please do.
Yeah, I was just going to echo what you said and just clarify that the information is pulled from the actual forms, the line numbers on the forms that the committees disclose. So the line numbers, related to contributions of federal candidates, independent expenditures, coordinated expenditures. So the intent is for the public to make their own, you know, determinations based on the data, whether or not they want to contribute to a particular committee. So that's the extent of it.
Thank you, Mr. Kona.
Well, I'm interested in what do we do if we see some problems with who decides what should be done?
Madam Chair.
Please, Mr. Kona.
So the website would be for the public, so which is completely different from the review process, right? So the review process is an internal function, and the website is for the public to make those determinations on whether or not they want to contribute. So, defining it as a problem would be for the individual making the contribution to decide.
So is there I thought there was some reference to an appointment to advising the Department of Justice of some appearance of wrongdoing. Is that any part of the thinking in that regard? And if so, who would be the ones to decide what to say and who to contribute to work with? Yes.
Yeah, I understand your concerns. That is not a part of this document that is on the open meeting.
Okay.
So I appreciate those concerns, but it is not a part of this proposal. Is consisting of two things, a web forward facing website highlighting, and also a educational video that could be published. So nothing of those sort.
I see.
So thank you.
Sounds good. Thanks. Thanks.
Commissioner Traynor.
Madam Chair, I just have a technical question, I guess, for the IT developers. So would we need to make changes to the terms of service agreement for those that use FecFile, that we're going, how we're going to be manipulating this data and what we're going to be using it for. Is that something that we would need to notify them in advance of? That's just a, I guess that's a technical question.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Mr. Clark.
I'm not sure I'm the best person to ask. The change to the database is pretty straightforward. You know, it's just adding line numbers together and dividing by another line number. If we need to notify the filing community about these changes, that may be a question that Debbie knows better, or maybe OGC could better answer. But I'm not sure. I mean, obviously, we would make changes if that they're necessary, but I'm not sure I'm the best person to make to answer that question.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Yes, Commissioner Traynor.
I'll just throw this out there for whoever wants to answer it. So my biggest concern with using the data and manipulating the data to come up with a number on the website is that we put ourselves in the position of picking winners and losers based upon the data that we select to be used to come up with the number to say that this appears to be a scam pack or this doesn't appear to be a scam pack. And obviously we have the ability to catch somebody who's innocent of that activity in that whole calculation. So I think we need to be very cautious about what data we use. And we need to control for certain things that are different amongst the different packs. You know, the overhead cost for a pack in New York City is obviously going to be significantly different than the overhead cost for a pack in Marfa, Texas. I mean, those things have to be controlled for. And you're going to see, you know, a certain amount going to rent in one of those that's higher than another, and that's going to skew the data. So I think as we continue to look at this information, we need to make sure that we're using the right numbers and that we have appropriate controls and appropriate disclaimers for the data that we are using when we do that, because we don't want to be in the position of letting the world know that someone. Look, I'd rather have several scam packs go free than for us to hurt the legitimate interests of somebody who is actually working to do real First Amendment political speech. And I think we all probably believe that. But so I think you're right. This needs to continue to be looked at. And I think we just need to make sure that there are appropriate controls in place for the various data points that we're using.
Thank you, Commissioner Traynor. I think those are all very valid points, which is why we are here and asking them to go forward and look further into those questions. So that directly goes to the definition that I asked regarding direct candidate support, if there's another metric. So thank you for that addition to the discussion. But let me ask if there is anything further. If not, Vice Chair.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. Just very briefly. I appreciated the shout out, though. This is your document. I was happy to let you take point and get the glory on it. I'm glad we're having this discussion. I'm glad that we're moving forward on these things. I think this discussion shows that this is a technical and difficult question, and kind of is an excellent example of how. And ClausBest has this old, you know, phrase that everything is simple, but the simplest thing is difficult. And that's come to mind several times since I joined the commission. So I'm glad we're having this. I'm here mostly for the briefing, which I found very useful. I do want to just echo, though, what Commissioner Walther said, that was not involved in this document. You know, that to the extent that criminal activity is going on, the public should take some comfort that we're aware of that, and that this is separate from our statutory role in sending criminal matters over the Department of Justice for criminal prosecution. So that got a little bit mixed up. I see them as parallel efforts, but I want to make that clear before we move on. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair. I agree. I do consider them parallel efforts. But the effort that I hope that we can work here is to catch this at the start, so that if we can make sure that our contributors are under understanding of where their money goes, then maybe they won't get in that position that we have to end up referring. But I do agree that the DOJ component or law enforcement is an important part of this. So thank you again to Mr. Kona, Mr. Scott, Mr. Clark, and Mr. Lance for your presentation today. I appreciate you taking the time and all the efforts, and we are going to hold this matter over to a later open meeting and continue to work on that. So thank you very much. That turns to management or administrative matters. Mr. Staff Director, are there any management or administrative matters the commission needs to discuss today?
Madam Chair, there are no such matters.
Thank you very much. The meeting stands adjourned. Thank you, everyone.